This is KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Carly Huckles.
And I'm Ryan Larson. Colorado has a thriving hemp industry, and this November, voters will be asked to remove the definition of hemp from the state constitution.
At first blush, I think it could appear as if we're trying to make hemp illegal again.
But supporters of Amendment X say the move will help preserve the industry.
We'll also take a look at two items voters will see on the ballot for funding transportation projects. They both find a way to pay for road construction, but each one goes about it a little differently.
We have a strategy where you pay very little and we can get huge improvement.
We don't know what we're getting with this tax increase.
Then we'll find out how one Northern Colorado school is teaching people to reconnect in an unusual way.
Plus, KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz explores some of the films at the upcoming Denver Indigenous Film and Arts Festival. But first, a national gun violence prevention group is running a $1.5 million ad campaign in Colorado's competitive 6th Congressional District, backing Democrat Jason Crow. The Republican incumbent, Mike Kaufman, is in turn airing his own gun-focused ad. KUNC's Lee Patterson has more on the push to make guns an issue in the race.
The campaign is backed by a group called Giffords, named after Gabby Giffords, the former Arizona congresswoman who was shot in the head in 2011 and survived. In this TV ad, a mom and a daughter are texting. The daughter's at school, and there's someone with a gun. The mom writes that she's on her way. The daughter doesn't respond.
Mike Kaufman's NRA rating, A. Giffords PAC is responsible for
this election season. There are a lot of gun-related ads out there, especially ones pushing gun control. According to a Wall Street Journal analysis, so far this year, ads promoting stricter gun regulations have aired around 100,000 times across the country, compared to around 4,500 times in 2014. And Gabby Giffords, along with her husband, Captain Mark Kelly, are part of that effort.
Good morning, everybody. Great to be here at this VFW.
We met in Aurora during a campaign stop last week. They're on a cross-country trip, stumping for 7 House candidates in 6 states, all Democrats and all veterans.
So we look for candidates that, first of all, that they might not definitely win, right? We want to be helpful. We want to get them. We want to be a part of getting them across the finish line.
Like here in Colorado's 6th Congressional District, which is home to the 2012 Aurora theater shooting. The Columbine High School shooting happened nearby.
My name is Jason Crow, and I've come here to win this race and to move forward on gun violence prevention in this country.
Crow, the Democrat, isn't a single-issue candidate, but guns have come up at almost every one of his campaign events. He's done a TV ad, he's sent out mailers, including one about taking on the NRA. His argument is basically that his life experience gives him credibility.
I grew up a hunter.
And later, he became an Army Ranger.
And folks, there's a good reason why I didn't deer hunt with an AR-15. And why I didn't take my deer hunting rifle with me to Iraq and Afghanistan. They're different weapons. They were designed to do very different things. And I know that better than anybody.
Crow believes that the Second Amendment and gun control measures, like expanding background checks and limiting high-capacity magazines, can coexist. Republican Congressman Mike Kaufman is also a veteran, and his philosophy doesn't sound so different.
I respect the Second Amendment. I don't believe it's just about hunting. I believe it's about self-protection, but I believe in responsible gun ownership. There needs to be, I think, rational regulations to limit gun violence.
But the two emphasize different methods of dealing with the issue. In May, Kaufman introduced a bill that would help states fund red flag laws, allowing law enforcement to temporarily take guns away from someone in crisis. He also talks a lot about a program called Safe to Tell that helps students and others report someone who could be a threat. But generally, Kaufman says he's never been particularly focused on guns.
I get that it's going to be a focus on this campaign more because of my opponent than anything else.
I asked him about the Giffords organization getting involved in his district.
First of all, I think they believe in the issue. You know, obviously, I have differences with them, but I think they passionately believe in gun control. And they also see an opportunity to flip the House. So they're gun control advocates, but they're also staunch progressives.
Gun control has not always been a winning issue in Colorado. After the Aurora theater shooting, state lawmakers passed a package of gun control laws. In response, 2 Democratic senators were voted out of office in a recall election, which was the first in Colorado's history. Nationally, the episode became a symbol for the heated debate over gun control. But Captain Mark Kelly, he thinks that this time around, gun control...
What do you want to bet it wins this time?
Because, he says...
Just look at what's happened in the last 18 months, right? You have the Pulse nightclub shooting, followed by about a year later, the shooting in Las Vegas, worst mass shooting in our country's history. A month or 6 weeks after that, the shooting in Sutherland Springs at the church. And then Parkland.
But it can be hard to predict how people will react to the messaging around gun issues. After that new ad aired, the one with the mother and the daughter texting, some said that it too closely mirrored a real school shooting that happened in Colorado back in 2006. And ultimately, the Giffords organization decided to make changes to that ad. Lee Patterson, KUNC.
Boulder County's Building and Safety Inspection Services office will be closed on Tuesdays until further notice due to a dramatic increase in residents filing hail damage claims. Hailstorms that hit the area this summer were so bad, police officers were rescuing kids off of the street from baseball-sized chunks of ice. Ron Flax is the building official for the county. He says new roofing permit requests are up more than 1,000% from this time last year.
So what we're doing is we are taking Tuesdays and just devoting those days to uninterrupted processing of permits and not handling walk-in clients.
With the new closure, permits should be processed in about a week's time. He says repairing damaged roofs in a timely manner is vital for homeowners. If left unchecked, it can lead to expensive leaking.
In addition to electing a new governor this November, Colorado voters will also see two items on the ballot to fund transportation projects. KUNC's Matt Bloom has more on Propositions 109 and 110.
To understand why there are dueling transportation funding questions on the ballot, you need to go back in time, specifically 27 years ago.
Remember 1991? George Bush was president? No, the other one. The Soviet Union was still a thing.
As this campaign ad also states, it was the last time Colorado raised the gas tax to 22 cents a gallon to pay for road projects.
So let's go, Colorado. Vote yes on 110.
The gas tax hasn't been an adequate source of funding for a long time, meaning more and more projects had to be put off to the point where now the state faces about a $9 billion price tag to get its current to-do list finished.
The reason we really strongly support Initiative 110 is it raises about $767 million a year.
Kelly Bruff is president and CEO of the Denver Metro Chamber of Commerce. 110 would raise the statewide sales tax from 2.9% to 3.52% for 20 years to pay back up to $6 billion in bonds. The funding would be divided among both state and local governments for projects.
The truth is, we need to pay if we'd like to improve our quality of life in terms of our transportation experience in the state of Colorado. And we have a strategy where you pay very little and we can get huge improvement.
We don't know what we're getting with this tax increase.
That's John Caldera. He's with the libertarian think tank Independence Institute, which is backing a different proposal.
We don't know what transit projects. We don't know what the cities will do with their slush fund. It brings in a lot of money, and we're not certain.
That certainty is exactly what Caldera is flaunting as the edge for Proposition 109.
It tells the Department of Transportation to bond for $3.5 billion to be used for 66 specific projects around the state. And it says you will get going on all these projects and you will not raise taxes or fees to pay it back.
109 is also bluntly called Fix Our Damn Roads. It's also a 20-year plan. Caldera says its biggest strength is that it's been done before.
It's not a new idea at all. In 1999, then Governor Bill Owens was facing a similar situation.
The state was flush with surplus money, but none of it was going toward roads. So Owens, a Republican, put forward a bonding question, the Transportation Expansion Project, or TREX. It added extra lanes to I-25 south of Denver and more than 19 miles of light rail track around the city.
And it worked beautifully.
But Bruff says the downside to Caldera's plan is that the money to pay back the bonds is not identified and would have to come from somewhere else in the state budget.
Most likely, we believe you'd have to take it either out of higher ed. Our higher ed funding is 48 out of 50th in the country. Out of our K-12 system, we're 55% of our school districts currently on 4-day school weeks, so they're probably going to have to go to less. And out of health care.
With both campaigns critical of the other's approach to the funding issue, the situation begs the question, what if voters pass both measures?
It's a wonderful intellectual question, but I don't see that at all.
Kelly Bruff's campaign also doesn't see it working out that way.
And so I think what you'd invite is a lot of legal wrangling about what you get to spend your money on in your local community. And we think that should be their decision about what's most important.
Neither Bruff nor John Caldera want to think about the other possibility, which is neither question passes. But if so, state lawmakers have a backup plan. They have a question on deck for the 2019 ballot that would ask voters to bond about $2 billion for transportation projects. Matt Bloom, KUNC.
Organizers with Meow Wolf have unveiled the first stages of their new social responsibility effort. The Santa Fe-based Arts Collective's upcoming Denver location will focus on the community, artists, the environment, and an inclusive economy. Denver artist and Meow Wolf Community Advisory Board member Javier Flores says he's excited to see the proposed changes.
There's been so much gentrification, so much change in our community, and that's really one of the things we really focus on the committee is keeping Meow Wolf accountable, and to their credit, that you know they always step up to the plate.
That plan also includes a 90% ADA accessibility rate, priority hiring for local residents as well as women and people of color, and a goal of 30% of its energy generated from renewable sources. The 90,000-square-foot exhibition space is set to open in late 2020 and expected to bring an estimated 1.5 million visitors to the area each year.
Brian, I don't know about you, but the last week or so, I've smelled it.
It's not me.
No, it's not you. It's the smell of fall. The leaves are changing color, the temperatures are dropping, and you can just smell the feeling of fall in the atmosphere. I know it's my favorite season, along with a lot of other people, but most people closely associate fall with school. In just a little bit, we hear about a school in northern Colorado that's a little bit different. It's focusing on a disconnect that's occurred for many in America.
We don't know where our food comes from. We don't know how the thermostat works in our house. We don't know all of these little practicalities that are our everyday life. And once everything becomes an abstraction, I feel like it leaves a void. It leaves an emptiness. And so I think people are hungry for reconnecting to their world.
We find out how a northern Colorado school is teaching people to reconnect, starting with their own 2 feet.
I think you're going somewhere with that. And we'll hear from KUNC film critic Howie Moshevitz and a review of a couple of the films that you'll see at the upcoming Denver Indigenous Film and Arts Festival. But before we get to those stories, let's unpack some more information on what's going to be on the November election ballot, specifically Amendment X. It seems like a way to curb Colorado's thriving hemp industry by removing the definition of industrial hemp from the state's constitution. But as KUNC's Esther Honig reports, supporters say it will keep the state competitive, as federal laws may soon change.
In college, Garrett Haas majored in computer science, but saw more opportunity in agriculture. 2 years ago, he took over his grandparents' farm in Lafayette and replaced the fields of alfalfa with rows of hemp.
I have a few different varieties. These ones are T1 right here. They're Trump hemp is what they're called.
No, the plants don't bear any resemblance to the 45th president. In fact, at this point in the growing season, they look more like miniature Christmas trees. Like most Colorado hemp, this 5-acre crop will be used to make cannabidiol or CBD oil.
Tinctures, oils, capsules.
It's the first year Haas expects to break even, and it's also an important election year for him and other hemp growers because of Amendment X. If approved, the definition for industrial hemp would be removed from the state constitution and put into the state statute.
I'm still a little confused of the differences in the constitutional versus the statute.
it's a complicated issue to unpack. For starters, laws in the state statute aren't as powerful as those written into the Constitution.
At first blush, I think it could appear as if we're trying to make hemp illegal again.
That's Democratic State Senator Steve Fenberg. He's a primary sponsor of Amendment X.
And we're by no means doing that. In fact, there's a chance that if we don't do this, the law could conflict in a way that it actually makes it so our hemp industry kind of suffers.
In 2012, Colorado became one of the first states to legalize hemp. It was written into the Constitution that industrial hemp cannot contain more than 0.03% THC. That's the same stuff in marijuana, its cousin plant, that gets you high. But recently, the federal government has gotten serious about national legalization. This summer, the U.S. Senate introduced a bill, and it could have a different definition of industrial hemp than what's in our Constitution. Hunter Buffington is the executive director of the Colorado Hemp Industries Association. She says that would be a major setback.
So it's really good public policy to actually move it from the Constitution and put it someplace where it can be modified.
Laws in the statute can be changed by a state lawmaker, whereas changing the Constitution requires voter approval. That's why hemp was put in the Constitution in the first place.
It really was put there to protect it in the very beginning and to make sure that it wasn't going to simply be removed the next year.
That gave farmers the confidence to invest in the crop. But now, 3 years later, Buffington and Fenberg agree that Amendment X would give the state the flexibility it needs to keep up with the changing federal regulations. And as more states begin growing hemp, Fenberg says Colorado won't lose its edge.
We want to make sure we're not disadvantaged in a way that actually puts us behind in any way.
Still, Amendment X creates some uncertainty for growers like Garrett Hawes.
I sense that you're hesitant. You're like, I just want it to stay the way it is.
Pretty much. For at least a couple years, I don't want anything to change too much.
Like all of Colorado's hemp farmers, Hawes has built his business according to current regulations. He spent a lot of time and money growing specific types of hemp that don't produce too much THC.
So it's constantly testing and just make sure that each strain doesn't go over that percentage threshold.
But if the federal government changes the definition by, say, allowing for 1% THC, it undermines all that work. While he thinks there could be benefits to approving Amendment X, Hawes says as a business owner, the prospect of change has him feeling pretty anxious. Esther Honig, KUNC.
You can find other ballot stories at KUNC.org. Early voting in Colorado begins the week of October 15th when ballots are mailed to registered voters. Back to school took on a whole new meaning this year in the tiny northern Colorado town of Bellevue with the opening of a new school. The class sizes are small and the instruction is completely hands-on. And as KUNC's Stacey Nick reports, the organizers are hoping to get a foot in the door on a new trend.
Dan Hewling and Annabelle Reeder aren't your typical couple.
And now, folks, we require silence, stillness for the audience, please.
For almost two decades, Hewling has been juggling chainsaws as part of the vaudeville troupe The Handsome Little Devils. And Reeder is a freelance costume designer and part-time stilt walker. They were looking for a way to slow down and stay closer to home, but they didn't want to lose their artistic edge.
We were building this studio, and we didn't know why we were building it. We're both creatives. We both need to make to feel sane.
Then, on a trip back to her hometown in New Zealand, Reeder learned about a shoemaking school. It seemed like a perfect fit.
Who doesn't love shoes? Who doesn't want to make their own shoes? It's so cool.
Because a big thing for us is passing on a skill as opposed to just being another product that's consumed.
So now you can trim this away.
So this summer, the couple opened the Colorado Shoe School, where students like Chris McCullough can learn to make everything from a simple slide to complicated boots, start to finish. Or in this case, heel to toe.
I made an attempt to make my own tap shoes once, but that just consisted of me hammering on some pieces of metal onto some old shoes. So I don't think that counts.
This time, the professional swing dancer from Fort Collins is crafting a pair of canvas slides. He says he's never really been into fashion, but the class has given him a new outlook.
So I don't own any kind of quote-unquote fashionable shoe. Maybe this will be my only pair of fashionable shoes that I ended up making.
For artist Andrew Bone, who is also from Fort Collins, shoe school is a chance to connect with something he says he and a lot of others take for granted.
We don't know where our food comes from. We don't know where our how the thermostat works in our house. We don't know all of these little practicalities that are our everyday life. And once everything becomes an abstraction, I feel like it leaves a void. It leaves an emptiness. And so I think people are hungry for reconnecting to their world.
There's also that feeling of pride that he gets when he slips on his custom fit creations from the school's bootmaking class.
And that's how I feel when I put these on every time. I feel like, I made these boots.
And the concept of shoe schools is gaining traction. Sarah McIntosh began making shoes in 1974. It started as part of her self-sufficient lifestyle, which included growing her own food and building her home. Eventually, she was able to build a business out of it.
I think that shoemaking really provided a unique opportunity for me to do something that was a little bit different.
McIntosh has run the Chicago School of Shoemaking and Leather Arts for the past 7 years. In the beginning, many of her students were looking at shoemaking as a trade, but lately it's become more of a hobby.
It's a bucket list kind of thing. I think there's a romantic notion about making shoes that has, occurred in our culture. The ruby red slippers and Cinderella and all of those kind of magical shoes. And, you know, it followed me through my career as well. Like, you make shoes? That's amazing. It's not something people expect to see.
And the statistics back that up. In the last 5 years, U.S. jobs in the shoe and leather industry have decreased by more than 30%. In Colorado, there were only an estimated 50 jobs reported in 2017.
We got this machine from an old cowboy boot maker.
Oh, really?
He's been making cowboy boots for 38 years. So we named the machine after him.
What's it called?
We call it Big Jim.
Back at the Colorado Shoe School, Dan Hewling says much of their equipment has, unfortunately, been purchased from cobblers either downsizing or going out of business. But for him and his fiancée, Annabelle, it's just about teaching people how to make shoes.
People will also be able to cherish their shoe a little bit more, know how to fix it when it needs to be repaired, and there's a little bit more of a relationship with the shoe. We are going to the extent of, you can write a little secret message in between the layers and no one will know it's there except for you, a little mantra. Or it has that whole, like a journey of 1,000 steps, you know, it's like.
If it turns out too perfect, no one will know that you made it. So.
I'm Stacey Nick, KUNC, in Bellevue.
You can find out more about the Colorado Shoe School and see photos of some of the shoes students have made at KUNC.org.
The 15th Annual Denver Indigenous Film and Arts Festival opens on October 4th with 5 days of films, art, and discussions. For KUNC film critic Howie Mofshevitz, who teaches film and television at CU Denver, the event is a chance to see rare and unusual films.
Indigenous filmmaking began to take shape in the early 1980s when portable video became available. Before that, relatively few people had access to the tools of filmmaking. It could be a question of money, location, or the complications of handling cumbersome equipment. Working with actual film at the time meant carrying many reels, which had to be sent off for processing after they'd been exposed, and also separate tape recorders and so on. None of this paraphernalia was available to people in remote places with no money, no training, no cultural apparatus or context for making films. So indigenous people could be the subjects of films, but not the authors of films. One of the early proponents of indigenous filmmaking, Vincent Corelli in Brazil, says that he grew sick and tired of seeing filmmakers from the outside world come into the Amazon region, gather images of people, and leave, making that filmmaker's vision the supposed truth about whatever Amazon village she or he had filmed. So when portable video became available, Corelli brought cameras to those Amazon villages, showed people how to use them, and watched as they told their own stories. And the world of indigenous filmmaking has grown. The guiding principle of the Denver Indigenous Film and Arts Festival is to showcase authentic voices of Indigenous people from all over the world. Over its 5 days, there are films from Hawaii, Canada, the Navajo Nation, Australian Aborigines, and New Zealand Maoris. Almost none of these movies will ever land on a screen in a multiplex, so the festival offers encounters with sights and sounds many of us rarely have the chance to see. The title of Kapiko, a short film from Hawaii by Bryson Kainoa Chun, refers to a traditional ritual of taking the umbilical cord from a newborn, wrapping it in leaves, and placing it in a mountain lake. In just 9 minutes, Kapiko shows how hard it is in the contemporary world for displaced people to hold on to what's meaningful to them. It's an unexpected plain language poem of a movie. A young widower and his father struggle over doing the ceremony. At the start, a newborn lies in a hospital, surrounded by the familiar, sterile rigmarole of modern medicine. The characters live in homes with appliances. The young man rides a motor scooter, the older man drives a pickup truck. All of these common elements militate against traditional practices. But as the film shows, community, family, and identity demand that the two find a way to transcend the gadgets, and as they chant, restate for themselves who they are. Kapiko's an understated, deceptively modest tribute to what matters. The short Canadian film Wakening by a Cree Métis woman, Denis Goulet, looks at environmental destruction. It's a dystopian dream set in a profoundly damaged urban landscape marred by military occupiers. Wisakachuk, a Cree woman, walks into a derelict movie palace, which radiates a sense of demoralized people and dreams gone bad. The light feels like swirling gray mush. There, Wisakachuk confronts, then acknowledges the help of an ancient bear-like figure. If Wakening is a horror movie, and if this figure is the monster, the film has the depth to let the audience dwell on it, like Wisakachuk, to feel the being's presence, and to see through its menace to its necessity for righting a world gone off the tracks. The best film I've seen in the festival, 3000, by Isabella Witaluktuk, mixes abstract animations that hint at native art and traditional designs and silent archival documentary footage from the 1920s, snow blowing across a pure white landscape, an igloo, close-ups of a sled dog and of children, an elk migration, kayaking, and other images, sailing a Western-style vessel, learning to write from a white man, and later footage of fishing with an outboard motor. The archival images resist nostalgia. They don't lament bygone days. Instead, they embody the richness of a still-growing tradition. For KUNC, I'm Howie Mopshevitz.
This has been Colorado Edition, made possible with support from KUNC members like you. Thank you for your support.
Our show this week was produced by me, Carly Huckles.
And me, Brian Larson. News director Catherine Welch contributed to our show, and Ashley Jeffcoat manages digital.
Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Calatana. Other music in this episode was Spinning Ratio with Long Way Home, Forest Robots, A Path Among the Woods, The Gold Lining by Broke for Free, You're Right, But I'm Me by Dr. Turtle, Eddie with the song Building Tension, and Chad Crouch with Wilson Snipe.
Our outro music is Good Grief by Ryan Little. And if you like what you're hearing, make sure you don't miss an episode. We'll be back next week with more stories.
Find Colorado Edition at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.